and welcome to the Game Audio Hour, a fortnightly podcast where we discuss all things game audio. From creative ideas to the latest techniques, project experiences to audio secrets, here is where you'll find in-depth coverage and opinions related to game audio. This is episode 243. I'm actually clipping a little bit more than I thought I would. Okay, let me turn that down just a bit. Just a bit. Back it off. I'm backing down the gain. There we go. I am Vincent Diamante, just hanging out here over in Southern California. And I'm talking with a guy that's all the way on the other side of the world. It's Alex May. How are you doing?
I'm pretty well, thanks. By the way, I found on a website today that the exact opposite side of the earth from Stockholm is somewhere in the Pacific Ocean, just east of New Zealand. So when you say opposite side of the planet, actually, I am not actually on the opposite side of the planet from you. I think, but I'm doing well, thanks. Sorry, that was totally irrelevant and, you know, not terribly funny. But anyway, I'm doing well.
That is okay. I think that we can stand a little bit of pedantry every now and then. And I think it's okay, especially considering you sound pretty good. Actually, yeah. did you change your mic or something? Or
That was a comment. That was a comment on the amazing new fidelity that I'm broadcasting to you with today. And that is actually thanks to to be truthful, it's not that, it shouldn't be that noticeable, but up until this point, I've plugged in this Heil microphone directly into my Focusrite, and being a dynamic microphone, which apparently is advertised to be especially good on extremely loud guitar amps and bass drums, the Heil needs a fair amount of juice from the preamp in that, yeah, normally I would be running the preamp basically maxed out in order to get decent enough volume for my speaking voice for these recordings. I finally thought, all right, I may as well do something about this. I've been thinking to do something about it for some time, but haven't really had the budget. I've been thinking that, you know, maybe I should get like a proper microphone preamp. Well, I mean, not that the ones in my Focusrite interface are not proper, but, you know, like an actual outboard mic pre. But that's I think I was waiting until I had the budget and the justification to spend a bit of money on such a device. And then I realized 2 days ago that, you know what, like I don't really record that much. I probably couldn't ever justify having an outboard mic pre, especially when the mic pre's in the Focusrite are very serviceable. I mean, they're not bad. They're good, you know. Instead, I started investigating what they call microphone activators, which is just a very fancy way to say an inline gain booster, like a clean boost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What would you call it? Like the Kleenex or the Xerox or the Q-tip of this market sector is the Cloud Lifter.
Yep. They've been around for a while, those Cloud Lifters. They got a lot of different versions of them, multiple channels, and
yeah, that's right. And they, for those who don't know, basically all these devices do, they run on phantom power via your interface or your mixer. And they basically just add usually around 27 to 29 dB of just clean gain. And it's especially useful for sort of gain-hungry dynamic microphones, such as the one that I'm speaking into, and it just basically allows you to run your preamps on your interface much, much lower, which theoretically means that your noise floor is going to be much lower at the same time, because and the microphone input is going to be so much more hot going in. So, yeah, there was the Cloud Lifter. In order of cost here in Europe, there's the Cloud Lifter, then there's Dynamite, and then there's the Triton Audio FET head. And I decided to go with the cheapest option here in Europe, which is the FET head, cheapest mainly because it's manufactured just a bit southwest of here in the Netherlands. And yeah, it's plugged in. It's an inline little thing. It looks like a XLR adapter. And you just basically plug it into the back of the microphone and plug your XLR cable into that. And there you go. You now have plus 27 decibels of clean gain. So how do I sound, Vince? Do I sound hot?
You always sound hot, Alex.
Oh, thanks, Vince. Excellent. Nicely done there. Yes.
No, you sound good, though. Yeah.
There's actually you alerted me to some interesting products from a company in Spain. The idea of the Triton Fethead, they have a few different varieties of it. The three ones that are the most useful for this kind of application, there's the Triton Fethead Filter, which is basically clean gain plus a high pass filter with a corner at 200 hertz. Mm. So that's really good for voice applications, basically, because often, you know, with dynamic microphones like this, especially if you come in close and you have a lot of proximity effects, you know, in post, you're going to end up, you know, cutting out a lot of that boom and the low end anyway, just to make the voice, you know, easier to hear on smaller playback devices.
Oh, yeah.
And, or especially larger playback devices too. Those have a really subby, boomy voice. So the Fethead filter actually has that. It's a 6 dB at 200 hertz roll-off on the bottom end, so you don't have to do that. It's nice.
Yeah.
The other one, which I'm curious to get your take on, and we're going to go way into the weeds of hardware here, so bear with us just for a brief moment, dear listeners. We'll be out of this little out of this patch of weeds in a moment. But the other one is it's called the Triton Audio Fethead Germanium. There we go. So
oh, man.
Any guitarists out there are now either very excited or they're shaking their heads, depending on which side of the fence that you sit with regard to like boutique guitar pedals. But yes, the Germanium model has a Germanium diode, I suppose. Is that what, or transistor? Is that what? I don't really. I'm a bassist.
Sounds about right. Yeah. Yeah, germanium transistors are a thing. I hear about them. I see them in a lot of products. Not a lot of products, but every now and then I see them on things. It's like, okay, this is going to sound big and warm and and kind of tube-like. I you know, people talk about, you know, that having a more tubey type of sound or a vintage type of sound.
We're going right into guitar pedal land here because germanium, yeah, I don't know that much about it. I'm a bass player, but it's big in overdrive pedals, fuzz pedals, distortion pedals. You know, germanium distortion, germanium overdrive has a distinctly different sound to silicon based distortion and overdrive. We'll have to. I think I will stop here because I know that there's likely to be a lot of guitarists listening who are saying, all right, he better get this right. So I'm going to stop there. But the Triton Audio Germanium has that in it. And in the end, I decided to go for just the plain vanilla clean 27 dB because, you know, I don't really know what kind of things I'm going to be recording.
Mm-hmm.
But I wonder really whether you would notice a difference. But the reason I got talking about this is because, you actually alerted me to a company in Spain that makes these kinds of clean boosters, inline boosters for microphones, but has a really interesting angle on it. Do you want to introduce our listeners to this?
Yeah, there is the clean stuff, but then there's also the not so clean. So basically, there's this company out of Spain called Tierra Audio. And they're really interesting, very small boutique company that they do a lot of cool boutique audio processing goods, and they're very ecologically minded. So they actually really stood out to me because I saw them at this last NAMM and at previous shows, and their rack gear would have these wooden faces, which is a very stark contrast from things like the brushed
dark metal faces or the clean silver look, whatever. No, it would be this one unit compressor or preamp or summing mixer. And it would be wood. It's like, whoa, that's a really striking look. And then you look into what they've got here. They got some interesting stuff. They got compressors, preamps. They make microphones. They make a lot of stuff. They're not a big company. They're not a Shure or a Neumann or SSL, whatever. But you know, the production world is a really interesting place that can sustain a lot of interesting stuff coming from people. And they've got interesting stuff too in the preamp world. So instead of making something like the Cloudlifter or the Fethead, which is basically just a thing that provides clean gain, you know, 20, 30 dB, whatever, they actually make a whole line of these preamp buffers that have different flavors to it. So they make a plain one, which is called Salt. And it's just, oh, boosted sound. It has it right on there. Boosted sound, ultra transparent, precision, and realism. Okay, that sounds good. And then, you know, if you're into cooking, you know that, oh, you put the right amount of salt on it and just, you know, meat tastes more like meat or vegetables taste more like those vegetables, etc.
It just lifts it.
Yeah. And then you've got things like pepper and truffle. And I think they have one called chili and mint. They're just really interesting. So I'm looking at the description for the chili preamp, which is kind of crazy. You're talking about your Fethead or the Cloudlifter, which goes, you know, in the 20s or 30 dB of gain. This one, it says the gain is plus 52.
Wow.
And it's made for in-your-face vocals. You know, it has an aggressive sound. It's extremely fast transients, but it also adds a whole bunch of even harmonics. They're doing stuff to it. It's not just, oh, we want a nice, clean add-on. It's not just clean gain. It's all this other stuff. What else can we do to this? Mint. Yeah. The Tierra Audio Mint preamp features a fresh sound, slightly bright, delicate, and musical. They say that it's perfect for enhancing darker voices. So, like a lot of ribbon microphones or the Shure SM7B, I guess the idea of having a nice little sprig of mint on, say, a dark chocolate type of dessert, maybe. They do all these things. Apparently, this one has a Lindahl transformer, while the chili preamp that I was looking at had a different transformer. Like, there's stuff happening in these preamps besides just pure gain. I think it's really cool that they're doing it. They're not the only company that I know of that does this. I think the first one that I saw that did something like this was actually the Soyuz Microphones Launcher. And they had this thing of, oh, it's a launcher. You know, we're boosting your gain, but we're actually pushing it even more. It says that we are imparting character and color while also boosting your gain. That's on their
pushing
website.
Pushing into outer space.
Yeah. So it's pretty cool, the types of stuff that you got there. And actually, when you were talking about the germanium thing, I'm not a guitarist, but it does make me think a lot about some of the stuff that I do to my sound in order to get that extra bit going there. So I was just working on this music track earlier this week, and I decided I need more and more and more in terms of that kind of vintagey richness that I'm trying to get. And yeah, I could try to get that with plugins, but I've got a somewhat easier way to do it with my hardware gear, because I've got a lot of places where I can add what I call heavy iron into the sound, because there's transformers and stuff that I can engage in different pieces of gear. I've got this SSL Fusion, which has a bunch of things on it, but one of the things that I've got is vintage drive in order to add a little bit of vintage density to the sound. It, you know, again, adding some both harmonics as well as messing around with that low mid sound character. Then I can engage a transformer in order to do some weird things to the sound. And then there's another transformer that I can choose to engage in this Neve master bus compressor that I've got. Like, okay, I'm just going to engage the transformer. What is it doing to my sound? It's doing some subtle stuff. It's doing some kind of funky, vintage-y type, warm type stuff. It's definitely doing its work, and that's kind of what I want to do, since this track that I was working on earlier this week, I'm trying to do something that's very, very acoustic. And it's very hard to get some of those sounds sometimes when you're dealing with these very pristine digital instrument emulations that we're working with, especially very synth stuff. I like working with physical modeling type stuff and additive synth type stuff. And I really need to find different ways to mess with the character and get that somewhat more real sounding. So I engage the hardware in that way. And when you were talking about the germanium, like, yeah, I kind of do something similar there.
What would be, in terms of hardware, you know, I think that probably most of us in game audio, especially when we're starting out in earlier stages of our career, most of us are basically, you know, just putting in the hard graft with a laptop and some headphones or something like that, or maybe a desktop and some speakers or something. So, you know, we've talked about it countless times before that when you've got your rig, firstly, the most important thing, probably arguably the most critical thing to upgrade first is the acoustics in your room, followed by your speakers, followed by maybe your interface itself for better mic pre's and maybe microphones. But in terms of external signal processing outboard, so when we're talking about external compressors or effects units or, enhancers or mastering devices or even EQ, things like that. What would be your recommendation for somebody who's looking to buy their first piece of outboard processing gear? Like what category, not specific products, but like what do you think would be most beneficial for someone if they're used to working in the box and now maybe they've got a bit of budget and they've got a bit of, you know, they can justify spending some money on some hardware outboard. What would you recommend as being the first thing that they get?
That's a really good question. And I'm kind of struggling with that right now because it took me a long while before I really got something interesting external. I mean, obviously I've messed with stuff, but it never stuck. You know, so I had played around with some things, whether it be using a mixer as part of my input into my interface or, some 500 modules. I was like, okay, I have a compressor or whatever, but I never really used that stuff. And it isn't until a couple years back that I decided on a couple of things that I think made a lot of sense for me. And that's really important to know. Like, this worked for me. I'm not sure if it's a general thing that I would recommend to everyone, but I think it could be useful. Probably the first thing that I reach for is EQ. Having a good hardware EQ, and in this case, it is this SSL Violet EQ, which is part of my Fusion box, since that is part of my monitoring and mastering. And we get it. You know, EQ for mastering is a very important piece of the puzzle. I find that having a really good physical piece with good, obviously, sound to it, but also a really solid connection between that sound and the manipulation of that interface right on the front there, is really nice and very educational. It really connects you with, oh, this is what I'm doing here. I am physically moving these knobs. Things are happening electrically to my sound, and I'm hearing the immediate result right now. And learning that was really good. You know, obviously, I had been exposed to many, many, many different types of digital EQ in the past two decades, and I kind of knew how to use them. It's, you know, they're very functional. There's nothing wrong with plug-in EQs these days, whether it be the stuff that's built into your DAW or something that you pay, you know, 10, 50, 100, 500 bucks for on the digital marketplace. You know, they're all really good. But a hardware EQ and just being able to really dial in precisely with these nice dials, with those nice potentiometers, and connecting with the physicality and the electrical nature of sound before it hits your ears, I think that is not just an upgrade in the potential of your sound, but also a learning experience that can help you figure out what other parts of the music production process do you want to have that connection to? And there are a lot of places there in the world. Like, some people might want to do further things with reverb. You know, they might go down that whole road of, oh, these are physical reverb units and spring reverbs and all that stuff. And other people might want to do things when it comes to delay units and compressors and all this stuff. But, you know, EQ, really big fundamental part of music production. And I think it's also a really good way to think about it as this part that you could have a different relationship with as outside of the box that you started in.
And it's we're talking about a fairly substantial change to the basic workflow that people would use, though, when they're trying to incorporate a hardware EQ, though, right? Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, you know, it's not with, I mean, obviously the benefit of digital EQ that is right there in your DAW, be it native or third party, obviously the benefit is that, yeah, it's on the track and you just double click it and there you go, there's your curve or your knobs or whatever. And you know, if you're in the middle of mixing, you decide, actually, I'll just go back and just tweak that a little bit. There we go, that's better. And you come back here. Oh, now I did it too much. I'll go back and I'll just pull it down a bit. Okay, that's fine. And obviously, when you're talking about a hardware EQ, how are you running that? Is it actually running through, it's at some point you've got to be printing that hardware EQ, the input from your hardware EQ has to be printed to a file to go into your DAW just to replace the source, right?
Yeah.
So, and of course, if you're doing that, for example, on a track by track or a bus by bus basis, we're talking about a rather big change. You know, some might say for the better, the idea of sort of committing that, right, okay, this is my tone. Okay, now I've just got to work with this, you know, like I've just got to work with that. And maybe that removal of those the viability of changing things, you know, the removal of those options could actually arguably be a healthy thing, which is a common argument that you hear about the benefit of, you know, committing and printing something and, you know, saying, right, that's done. I can't fiddle with it anymore. But is it not a rather, you know, I mean, that is quite a big workflow change, isn't it, if you're used to digital EQs?
Yeah, definitely a change. And for some people, it might require even more investment, because if you have an audio interface that's, you know, two in, two out, where do I put this thing? You know, and you might have to upgrade to something else, you know, another interface that has send return channels on it, or just many more channels of ins and outs. I mean, I'm lucky because I got this big ass RME. It's just dozens and dozens of channels in and out. So I'm like, okay, so it's actually pretty nice. I have various presets where I can click a button and then it's just routing. Oh, these things are now going out to this module and then back in through here, or maybe through a sequence of modules. Like, I'm going out to my SSL, which is also going into my summing mixer and then coming back in and all that.
Right.
But that's a significant investment there, because all those inputs cost a whole lot of money. And but thankfully, there's a lot more stuff that's available and affordable these days, where if you want to do multi-channel stuff, you can for, you know, $100 to $200 these days.
Yeah, a patch bay is a simple solution for that.
Oh, yeah.
Because if you have a patch bay, then you can just hook everything up on the back, and then when you want to take something from here to there, provided that you don't want to do it on multiple channels in real time, you can just, repatch things on the front, and you're ready to go. That's been the conundrum that I've had, to be honest. Like, I don't really, I work not even 99%, I'll say 100% with synthesizers and sort of electronic music. I don't really record that often. And so actually I barely record ever, really. It's mainly like voice stuff or like this kind of podcast stuff. And sometimes sound effects work, I'll be recording something, but it's primarily all music. So my Focusrite interface is like a, what is it? It's an 8 in and 2 out. That is, unless you have an ADAT, what do you call it? An ADAT?
An ADAT expansion, yeah.
Yeah, expansion, that's it. And then that can bump it up to like 16 inputs and an additional 4 outputs or something like that. So basically for my situation, I have, I've got a my beloved bank of 90s throwback romplers sitting next to me, including the legendary Roland JV-1080, mm-hmm. the Super JV. Although mine's not super because it doesn't have any of the expansion cards, so technically it's just a regular awesome JV-1080 as opposed to a super JV-1080. But anyway, I digress. So these are all basically occupying all of the inputs on my Focusrite. And so mm-hmm. I only have 2 outputs, which just go to my monitors, right? So anything that I want to get, any kind of outboard processing, would require me to either get a new interface or a patch bay so that I could have, you know, take the outputs of the FX device and put it into, some other input on the front to record what the FX processor is producing. Mm-hmm. So it means basically it's such a, that first step is a huge step. You know, just today, yesterday, when I went to pick up this FET head from the shop, I put in order, I had the FET head, I had an iLock USB key. I was browsing through, this is a slight tangent here, but I was browsing through the KVR forums. Every now and then, you know, there's basically a hate thread for the PACE iLock, the whole structure and system of it. Mm-hmm. And this poor person had basically, their Windows computer had updated and had done some kind of like BIOS update or something like that, meaning that all of their iLock software licenses, they didn't have a hardware key, so they were all actually bound onto the computer, and iLock buries some kind of identifier deep, deep into the system. And when you have a hardware failure for your computer, or in this case, when there's a BIOS update or something like that, then it actually mm-hmm. resets that identifier, so iLock sees the computer as a new computer, which means none of your licenses work. And then you've got to go through the process of contacting every individual developer that you've got an iLock license from and ask them to basically, reset your licenses because something happened to your machine, right? Have you ever had to do that? I had to do that once.
I think I did. Yes, I actually did have that problem on a machine that I had back in 2015.
Right.
And I think basically a video card failed, and I decided to take that opportunity to, if I'm going to go in my machine, maybe I should upgrade my processor as well. So I did that, and then right. I got a new video card, and everything is still there. But I booted up my machine, and it registered as a totally different machine according to iLock. So all of my stuff was not quite working. Well, not quite all of it. There were some things where, there were some things, I think UVI, that I was still able to do, because when you purchase it, they actually give you 3 licenses.
Right.
So
right.
Like, oh, okay, cool. I'll just do this one now. But then there were other plugins and software instruments where, oh, I could not use it anymore. And I actually had to message them, say, yeah, this computer that I used to have effectively no longer exists by courtesy of me upgrading. So can you please deactivate that so I can use it again?
Yeah, exactly. Like the for me as well, it's UVI, PSP, Eventide. Those are the main ones that I use. But anyway, getting back to the initial thing that I was talking about. So when I went to pick up, so I had the iLock and I had the FET head that I was buying. So the store actually had a secondhand Alesis MIDI-Verb Mark II.
Huh. Okay.
Yeah. And you know me, I am a sucker for that, you know, that classic 90s thing.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, oh yeah, maybe I should get that, you know, like a hardware reverb. That'd be cool. And the Alesis MIDI-Verb 2, I think Alesis or Alesis, if you like, the Quadriverb was their main, most famous reverb rack mount. But the MIDI-Verb 2, also, I mean, it's a kind of crusty, what is it? It's like a 12 or a 10-bit digital reverb. But it does have a distinct sound that you've heard on countless records from the 90s. I thought about it, and it was actually a decent price as well, like a good price for a MIDI-Verb 2. That'd be a cool thing to get, but you know, if I got that, then you know, now it means that, okay, I've got to get a patch bay because I've got no more inputs left, or I'd have to get an ADAT thing. And then so suddenly that reasonable price for the MIDI-Verb 2 would jump up hugely, just because now I've got to integrate a hardware reverb. And I have so many software reverbs, and almost all of them are extraordinarily great sounding.
You know? Oh, yeah, yeah.
I mean, they just sound fantastic. And I have my favorites amongst my collection of software reverbs. And of course, yeah, my tendency is often to apply too much reverb. And so having the means to then just easily in the mix process, just to dial it back, just, you know, open up the plugin and dial it back. It's easy. You know, I don't need to reprint anything. I don't need to like try and remember what the knobs were set to, or, you know, get annoyed at myself because I didn't save a preset. And now I've got to like try and figure out how to reproduce that reverb sound slightly less, you know, none of those worries because it's software. So it's a big step for me. And I probably quite a few people are also in a similar situation where the idea of having hardware processing is very appealing. But basically taking that step just involves not a small amount of expenditure, but one big large expenditure to kind of upgrade everything to accommodate the hardware.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But it is really cool when you do it. Like, honestly, I'd recommend you go for it. I mean, yes, there is that extra expense. You know, patch bays, yeah, you could get a decent patch bay for under $100. ADAT expansion, maybe not under $100, but there is this thing from Behringer. So
yeah,
you can just add 8 ins and 8 outs for about $200 US.
Yeah, I've had very, very bad experiences with Behringer before, so I get it. Don't think, yeah.
But that's the thing. It's like the only option, though. It's really crazy how that specific Behringer ADAT expansion is the only reasonable, you know, in and out option for expansion.
Right.
What other ones are there? There's Art. Actually, Art makes one.
Yeah, I'd make one as well.
Yeah, but that's an extra $200-$300 on top if you buy it new. I think you could probably get it maybe a little. Oh, gosh. Actually, it's $400 more. So that Behringer, $200. The next step up, the Art, which is $600 US dollars.
Right.
And then there are some other ones that are a little bit more expensive than that even. But
I mean, I think at that point, you may as well just buy a new interface.
Yeah. It's a little frustrating, but it is really nice to have those options, especially since you have those that old gear. You have old Romplers, you've got old synths. You mentioned the JV. You have a TX 81Z, right? And
I do, indeed.
Like, I remember I was talking with some other people about this stuff and saying that, you know, those things really did sound good back in the 80s and 90s. But a lot of what made it sound good was that whole signal path that they went through.
Yeah, of course.
It's going through, you know, going through a big-ass SSL console where up and down that whole channel strip, it's quality EQ, quality compression, and getting printed to tape, you know? And like, you know, all that hardware there in the middle actually does cool things to the sound. So a DX7 is far more than a DX7, or a TX81Z is far more than a TX81Z. But I also get it. It's pretty expensive.
I don't know, but would you get a MIDI Verb 2 if it meant suddenly having to jump in the deep end with expanding your whole rig and changing your workflow? I guess the answer is yes, really.
Man, probably. I mean, considering.
Yeah. Yeah. But anyway, it's you're absolutely right then. A lot of those older synthesizers, yeah, they actually don't sound that great. But when you put them through, these four that I have here, the Roland D110, which was that sort of predated the whole general MIDI. It was just before the MT32 and that sort of the dawn of general MIDI. And the D110 does not sound very good when you just, you know, set up an input and you just start playing something. It's kind of awful. But when you process it with modern plugins, and then of course if I had you know, actual outboard, it would also be great, if not better. But when you process it with modern plugins, add some chorus, add some, you know, some nice Tai Chi reverb or like a Valhalla reverb or something, some equalization, it sounds so incredible. And then you realize, okay, yeah, I get it. That's why in the 80s and the 90s, you know, those epic synthesizer sounds, it's probably, I don't know, maybe 60% the synth itself and maybe 40% all the cool outboard and studio signal chain that they had these things going through.
Yeah.
So anyway, hey, there's one other thing that I wanted to talk to you about today, which is I found quite interesting, actually. So last week I decided to stop playing Death Stranding.
Okay.
I'd been playing Death Stranding and enjoying it. No, not really enjoying it that much, to be honest. But certainly appreciating it. Like every aspect of it is just fantastic. I mean, it's just an excellent example of a, you know, where video games have come to. It's amazing. I don't really enjoy that many aspects of it, but just in terms of the design and the execution of it, fantastic. Anyway, so I decided to stop playing it because I think I'd sort of gotten to the point where I had gotten from this experience what I came for. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I said, I'd like to see what happens with the narrative, so I'll just like watch a long play on YouTube. I was like, wow, like 11 hours for the whole, that's just like all the cutscenes with no action. 11 hours of cutscenes. It's like, oh my God, 11 hours. I realized.
That's Kojima style.
Yeah, 11 hours of just purely cutscene. Anyway, I'd realized I'd actually gotten halfway, almost exactly halfway. So I watched the rest of the story and it's all really good, etc., etc. I thought, you know what, I don't seem to have noticed the soundtrack while I was playing. Like, there were a few moments when I was definitely aware that there was music going on, but I couldn't particularly, like, I couldn't place any, you know, moments when it's like, oh, the music here is epic. So I went and listened to the soundtrack on Apple Music, the Death Stranding soundtrack. Man, the soundtrack is absolutely fantastic.
Hmm.
But the point of conversation here is that, like, often we're going to get philosophical now. So we're going from all the way in the hardware side of the of the like the gear side of the conversation now, all the way across the other end of the spectrum to the the philosophy side here. So prepare yourselves. Hopefully, listeners of the Game Audio Hour will probably be somewhat used to that by now. But anyway, okay, we're going to get philosophical here, Vince. So
okay, I've got my hat.
Right. So, in listening to the soundtrack of Death Stranding and discovering, despite having played it for, I don't know what, well, if it's 11 hours of cutscenes plus gameplay, I guess I must have played it for about a total of, I don't know, 12 hours or so, including all the gameplay. Discovering for the first time and listening to the soundtrack, all of these amazing pieces of music, and then thinking to myself, well, I didn't actually notice very many of these while I was playing. It was so expertly and seamlessly integrated into the experience that I actually just genuinely didn't notice. In general, you know, the mood of the game is done exceptionally well, and that is in no small part thanks to the music, of course. You know, that's our job in game audio. But it's interesting, isn't it, that like often the objective that we are striving for, especially with music, is to integrate it into the overall texture of the experience in such a seamless way that in some cases the player doesn't really notice. And the work of one of our previous guests, Martin C. Anderson from Denmark, his work is an excellent example of that because, you know, if you think of the soundtrack to Limbo or Inside or Control, you know, especially the one that I played the most of those is Control. And that's another fine example where you really don't notice the music very much at all. Part of that is because Martin's style is very abstract. So it kind of blurs the line between ambience and sound effects and music, which is really cool. And that's obviously one of his signature areas of expertise. But being that it's so well integrated, and it was the same in the case of Death Stranding, it was so perfectly integrated into the experience that I just didn't notice. And then when I went to listen to the soundtrack later, it was like, wow, like check out all this great music here. This is great stuff. How come I didn't notice it while I was playing? So the philosophical question that I was interested to ask you here is like, yeah, if our goal is to integrate music in a way that it supports the emotions of the game, it supports the context of the game in terms of narrative or the gameplay mechanics or whatever the player is doing, and we pat ourselves on the back when we do such a good job at that, that it fits in so perfectly with the entire experience, the art and the interaction design and the controls and the narrative and the character design, all of that. The music slots into that jigsaw puzzle so perfectly that the player doesn't notice at all. Have we ultimately succeeded or have we ultimately failed as composers of music for video games? What do you think about this?
Oh, I've definitely thought about this a lot, and I think a lot of it comes down to, you know, sense of self, and you know, who are you in this process? And my immediate thought is that it would be a success, but I also have, for a long time, considered myself a game developer that works primarily with music and audio. As opposed to a music composer. And, you know, there's a lot of different relationships between music composers and the games that they work on. You know, some people have these divides that exist where, oh, I'm just licensing my music out to you. And then things where they're super integrated into the team because they're just there. Like, I mean, I had worked inside of that game company for more than a decade. You know, I was a that game company employee, just the same as any game designer, programmer, artist, etc. And so, you know, my relationship with them and my relationship with the game was very much, it's about the game. It's about the game's ultimate success. But then there's also other places in that gamut there. And so much of how music works is connected to its individual memorability, right? Do people actually get that there is a melody here? Do people get that there are these things that are happening inside of the music, where there are, you know, cool techniques happening in and of itself, cool things happening in composition, in production? I imagine that I would have a very different answer if I had very different relationships with both the game as well as my collaborators on these works. You know, if I was just a music composer contractor throwing stuff at them, and obviously probably a little more than that, you know, we'd probably have good conversations, emails and constant calls, and, you know, playing the game together in order to make sure that things were actually happening the way that we would like. But being a musician that is separate from everyone else would probably have me with a different relationship with the music and the product itself, where I'm thinking, I want my music to be successful because that's ultimately the thing that I am selling to my collaborators. You know, I am selling this music to my collaborators, versus, oh, I am working inside of this company. I'm not collaborating with them. I am part of that game company, and ultimately the thing that we are making is this game, and everything that's there is part of the overall success of the game. So I guess it's just a long-winded way of saying it really does depend on how you want to position yourself with games and the people that make them. And when I started out in this business, I had a very strong feeling about where I wanted to be in that space. And it wasn't just like, oh, I want to be successful or whatever. It was, I want to be working alongside designers and programmers and artists, because that was the type of connection that I wanted to have with the games that I was working on. That was also the connection that I wanted my part of the production to have with everyone else's part of the production. So that's kind of how I see it. But that's my perspective, and that's coming from, where I've been for the last few decades, working primarily as an in-house music and sound guy for, you know, so many people.
One thing that we can say for sure is that regardless of whether your target is to have your music stand out or whether your target is to have your music blend in, if you're doing it badly, people will notice, and and that detracts from the overall experience. So whichever way you're going to go, you have to do it well. Okay, so of course we know that. Once you've established that, you know, I find it curious that if you blend your music in so well to the experience, how often do players actually notice the fact that you've blended it in so expertly? You know, I've used this analogy many, many times before, and I'm very sorry to our regular listeners because you're going to have to hear me say it again here, but like a bass player in a band, sorry, it's like every second episode I make this analogy, but like a bass player in a band, right? You know, if you take a bass player who's like a good solid rock bass player, like say AC/DC's bass player, whose name has just escaped me, I think it was Cliff something. Anyway, like he doesn't do anything fancy on the bass at all. He's just basically, you know, holding it down, but it's such a core essential role in the sort of overall sound of AC/DC, his bass lines. They're very simple. They're easy to play. There's nothing amazing going on, but they're just sort of solid, good, reliable bass lines that, especially with the extremely expert arrangement that AC/DC does and their use of tension, It just fits in that pocket so perfectly, right? But when has anybody who doesn't really care that much about musical technique and performance and only cares about the emotional aspect of music, when has anybody said, man, you know what? I really love AC/DC's bass player. Very rarely. On the other side of it, if you take somebody like Geddy Lee from Rush, also rock, although I mean, it's obviously, you know, you've got sort of 70s hard rock versus progressive rock, but Geddy Lee is obviously a far more sort of flamboyant player. It's hard to compare them, of course, because Rush is a progressive rock band and they are three people. AC/DC has a totally different objective. But, you know, when you think about bass players, when people say, man, you know, that bass player is just incredible, especially people who generally, they only care about the emotional aspect of it. It's usually because the bass player is doing something to stand out more, despite it actually fitting in well. They're trying to stand out more. You know, if we go back to video games, winding back the clock, at least from my upbringing with games on the Commodore Amiga, you know, it's all of the games that have these soundtracks that are just way out there. They're the ones that I remember. You know, like, for example, Turrican or Speedball 2 or Gods by the Bitmap Brothers or Xenon 2 or any of these titles. They had soundtracks that were just way out there. And I think in those days, because the objective was to show, hey, look what we can do with our technology here. You know, it was more of that demo scene culture on the Commodore Amiga where you were trying to basically show off a lot of the time. The music would often be like really... there are other limitations. The reason why you cannot make a music track fit in so seamlessly with everything, just because the hardware limitations. And fast forward from those days to today, you know, when we did Space Folk City together, for those who don't know, this is by my company Moon Mode, and it's a VR city building game. Generally, for a city building game, the soundtrack, generally you would imagine you want it to be, you know, quite low key and quite subtle and just sort of there in the background is a nice kind of ambient accompaniment to the things that are going on. And of course, the Space Folk City soundtrack is nothing like that at all. And, you know, Vince, you know, your and my objective in doing that really was just to have as much fun as we possibly could and just make it crazy and just out there. And guess what? You know, I mean, I don't know how many people have ever said that the soundtrack to SimCity or City Skylines is excellent. Perhaps, I'm sure they are excellent soundtracks, but we were very, very lucky to have a lot of people, reviewers and players alike, say how good the soundtrack was. Now, I have to wonder, is it good because we did an excellent job at it? Well, yes, of course, but no, actually, is it because of that, or is it because we didn't try necessarily to blend it in so subtly? We really wanted it to be more kind of flamboyant and extravagant and just sort of, you know, a lavish amount of fun with the game audio. So therefore, people just tended to notice because we didn't try to blend it in so seamlessly, which is more successful, you know, in terms of, you know, the music. Fortunately, obviously, the context is very important here, and obviously with Space Folk City, to look at it, it's a very, very whimsical, bizarre, weird, oddball kind of vibe, and so we therefore had that liberty to kind of take the music in that direction as well and make it, you know, somewhat of a, not a statement, but, you know, somewhat of a, just to have some fun with it and to be a bit extravagant with it. That question then becomes like, well, people really noticed our soundtrack in that game. Mm-hmm. Would they have had such good comments about it if our objective was to make it so that nobody would notice it, you know? And would that therefore have been successful from a game audio side? Other game audio professionals might have looked at that and thought, wow, this is an excellent job. Look how seamlessly the music is integrated into everything else. Whereas players may just not have even noticed at all. which is kind of how I felt about the Death Stranding soundtrack. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm playing it, trying not to think like a game audio engineer, and I'm trying to play it like a player and not really noticing the music very much at all until I listen to the soundtrack. Makes me wonder then, wow, you know, okay, from a game audio aspect, it's highly successful. From a player consumer aspect, is this successful or not? Like, that I didn't notice it. So, yeah.
Let's see. There's so many places that I can go from there and only so much time, but let's see.
Yeah.
It's so funny. Like, you were talking about the demo scene, and I immediately thought about how, you know, so much of that scene comes from a certain confidence and pride and individual machismo that turns into these amazing digital artworks where, oh yeah, the artist is totally showing off and the programmers are totally showing off and the music is totally showing off. Like, everyone is a soloist. And then you mentioned City Skyline, and then it reminded me that, oh, right, the music composer for City Skylines is Purple Motion from Future Crew.
Oh, right. Actually, I didn't know that.
It's
Future Crew, a Future Crew, right?
Yeah. Motion. And like, oh, man, second, he was so good. And
Second Infinity, was it? No, Second
something. Reality.
Yeah, that's it. Second Reality. It was just classic.
Yeah. You know, City Skylines is actually a really nice sounding game. It's
okay.
And but I would say nice. You know, it's smooth. It's
right.
It's elegant. But I also would probably be, even if I really thought about it, I'm not sure if I would say that, oh, it's stand out in the way that other things are stand out, especially games that have their music front and center as a real hallmark, as something to really hang your hat on. Gosh, you know, there are so many things that you want to do when you're making a game, right? You want to have this amazing experience, but you also want to have something that is easy to propagate out there with the masses. And sometimes it's something like, yes, this thing has amazing music. Listen to this awesome track where these guys just rip. You know, that's part of the business of it. Like, I guess, let's see, going back to something like Skullgirls, for example.
Yeah.
You asked me about this last time we were on the air. And, you know, one of the things about that game was that I was not the lead composer. I was the audio director, and we were working with Michiru Yamane, who was the music composer. And she was very much a bullet point. She was a bullet point when it came to us as a developer selling to publishers, saying that this game was going to be worthwhile, as well as selling to consumers and end users that, hey, this game is going to be worthwhile because, you know, this composer, she's awesome. She's done all these great games that you've heard of before, going all the way back to Castlevania in the mid-90s.
Right.
You know, and it's not a bad thing that. It's not a bad thing having these things be commercial artworks, and you have to consider the commercial feasibility of these things as you're putting it out there for people to consume. You know, it just sort of is the nature of it. And sometimes these things actually connect with overall dev decisions. Hey, we're going to mix the music like this. We're going to develop these features in order so that sound effects and music are going to be highlighted in this particular way. And it will be great because it will help people further engage and remember the music and sound effects beyond just the game, which is perhaps a little bit harder to convey. Yeah, so hey, yeah, this battle track is awesome. Bam, this battle track is awesome. It rips. It is hot. And we're going to make sure that people know it as quickly as possible. So, hey, you know, that's all good. It's not necessarily Yeah, I would say, yeah, that's all good that. So I think I have a particular way of thinking about music and its connection with the game, where I actually am pretty reticent to stand out too much. I think a lot of that is because I've always been one of the guys working on the game alongside the programmers, alongside the artists, etc. And so I don't want to necessarily stand out too much. It's I'm so focused on the game itself and not just, oh, what's the music? You know, the music is always going to serve the game as best as possible. And that's not to say that it's better. I think it's just, you know, that's how I've decided to connect with everything.
Yeah, that's really interesting that actually you point that out, because that's probably one of the reasons why, you know, the Space Folk City soundtrack was very successful artistically from my perspective, just because of that balance, because I'm the exact opposite. I also, like, you know, I own this company that made this game. So, it's fair to say that I'm part of this team that made the game as well. Mm-hmm. But right from, because also like you being the in-house music person, right from the early point in talking with Teresa, our artist, about what the game is going to look like and feel like, already at that point, I'm saying, okay, what kind of musical style can I explore here that is going to allow me to basically make a statement with the music and make it really, really stand out, but obviously not overshadowing the other important aspects of the game. And I guess when you're early on in the process of developing a game with your composer, you can do that, because you can make sure that there's enough space to give the music, you know, the opportunity to just go really go ham with it all, whilst not overshadowing everything else. It's a little harder when you get further down the track. Like if you're a contractor and you come into the project, typically, as it is for, unfortunately, too many of us in the game audio world, like you're, I don't know, like 4 weeks before you've got to submit for beta or something, and all of a sudden they realize that they need a soundtrack. That's obviously a much more difficult context to be trying to make some kind of musical statement in. And it's probably wiser in that situation, unless there's a specific call for it, to make your music much more subtle and sort of blend in. But it is interesting that, like, maybe for me personally, I think because I grew up consuming that Commodore Amiga culture and the demo scene culture, basically, yeah, music has to be as freaking good as you can possibly make it. And it's just got to, like, just slam. It's got to stand out. It's got to be big. It's got to be brash. It's got to be bold. It's got to have people, you know, nodding their heads and players saying, man, the soundtrack for this game, you know, that's, for me, that's what I like to do. Of course, you know, there's a time and a place for that. And of course, there are games where that's definitely not what you want. And I guess one of the benefits, or maybe the drawbacks potentially, for people who don't like the games that we do, of you know, running your own company that makes the games for you with your music, is that you can call the shots. You know, basically you can steer things together with your team members from an early point, such that you have the opportunity to do those things with the music, rather than, you know, having an audio spec that's been decided by somebody else, and you basically need to make something that's much more subtle and consistent with everything else. But not consistent. It should always be consistent, but subtle and blended in with everything else, I should say.
Yeah.
So, well, unfortunately, we did it again. We went from hardware all the way across to philosophy. So, yes, our apologies, dear listeners.
That's okay. You know, I don't think too many people got whiplash there.
Yeah, that's right. So I think it's about time to wrap things up. And, of course, that means it's time for, Vince,
conspicuous consumption.
There we go.
This is the part of the show where we talk about what we've been consuming lately, whether it be games or movies or music. There's a lot of stuff out there. So I'm going to throw it to you, Alex. Have you been playing anything lately?
I have, actually. And it's been bad. It's been on repeat. I've got an album that's been going on repeat for almost all week. Just after saying these things, if you're listening to this for the first time, and this is the first time you've been to tune into a Game Audio Hour, and you're thinking that this Alex guy is basically a synth head who likes making really stupid, kind of brash, bold, dumb synth music, well, this is going to be a bit shocking for you. The album that I've had on repeat all week is actually... It's actually Rachmaninoff's Vespers, sung by the Swedish radio choir.
That's cool. So,
yeah, Rachmaninoff Vespers is an 8-part choral work. It's absolutely divine, and being 8-part, the harmony is just absolutely sublime. I mean, it is dense. It is just. It's beautiful. It's sad. It's sort of devastating. It's moving. It's emotional. It's just Russian music, you know.
Oh my gosh!
It's so thick and kind of full of all of this, you know, tension and beauty and just serene escapist. I don't know, ecstasy. That's what it is, mm-hmm. And. The Swedish radio choir has been my discovery in the last year, actually, that the Swedish radio choir and the Swedish radio orchestra are absolutely phenomenal. And I've had the opportunity to go and listen to both the choir and the orchestra in their home hall, so to speak, in Stockholm. And there is something very distinctive about a Swedish choir. And it's not just my opinion. There is actually... quite a popular opinion amongst connoisseurs that Swedish voices have some kind of distinct characteristic to them that lends itself especially well to choral singing and ABBA and Roxette. Anyway, so there's an album on Apple Music and Spotify, which has, I think it's an old, sorry if I'm offending anybody, but I don't exactly know what the cover of it is quite a famous, I think it's a print of the face of Jesus Christ. And it's the Swedish radio choir singing Rachmaninoff Vespers. And that's been going on repeat, and it has been wonderful. So I'm not all synths, just mostly.
Wow. Okay.
Anyway, back to you, Vince. So what have you been either playing or reading or watching or listening to this week?
I've been trying to actually play some Russians, actually. So, I've got a piano. It's cool. Especially when I'm actually playing the thing. So right now I am trying to play some Scriabin etudes. I've learned a few of them over the course of my collegiate classical piano career. And right. I'm realizing that a few of them is not nearly enough because, quite honestly, like those early Scriabin etudes are just awesome. They're like some of the best fun little pieces of music. Like if you're familiar with Chopin, it's kind of like Chopin on steroids.
Right.
And just, this is nice. This is fun. And playing that again, just trying to play my piano a little bit more. I've been trying to break up the work that I've been doing recently with some stuff away from the computer. So instead of turning on the PlayStation or going onto Steam and looking at something, go to the piano and just try some stuff out. And I've got these etudes and preludes and other stuff. Scriabin is really great. Another one of those later Russian composers, a little bit crazy, yeah. And wonderful sound.
He was a contemporary of Rachmaninoff. Was he Rachmaninoff's teacher, or was he a student together with Rachmaninoff with somebody else? I believe there was some connection like that.
I don't know if he was...
He was a contemporary.
Oh no! Yes, he was actually shared a teacher with Rachmaninoff.
Right, that's right, that's right. So yeah. He was his peer, basically.
Yeah. Great composers.
I mean, just incredible. Anyway.
So that's cool. The Russian composers, they're pretty awesome. pretty awesome. I highly recommend them. And with that recommendation, I guess we have to bring this episode to a close. This was episode 243 of the Game Audio Hour. If you liked what you heard, feel free to support us by subscribing to us at your podcast purveyor of choice and leaving us a review to keep us at the forefront of the algorithm. You can also follow us on Twitter at Game Audio Hour, where we will post notices about future episodes, as well as try to support some other fun and positive voices out there in the Twitterverse. And of course, the easy way to do all of this without having to remember any of that is to go to GameAudioHour.com. So go ahead and do that while I deal with this 8-year-old Android tablet. That's not too old, right? I'm trying to see if I could install TouchOS C on this Android tablet that I haven't used in years.
That should be possible.
It should be, but gosh. You know, I don't really have that much Apple stuff. But all the old Apple stuff I have, it just works. Like that, I have a 10-year-old iPad. It works. This one is not 10 years old. It is significantly younger than that. And it's, I don't know. I don't think it's usable. Whatever.